ageism, the last accepted bigotry?
To say that someone is too old for something, or too young for that matter, is like saying they are too queer or too black. It is bigotry, straight and simple.
That's Ashton Applewhite. We talk with her about her manifesto against ageism, This Chair Rocks. Then we speak with geriatrician Louise Aronson about her book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our free podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. If we're really lucky, we all get old. So why is ageism the last accepted bigotry? And what does it cost us as a society? Plenty, it turns out. In her book, This Chair Rocks, Ashton Applewhite says the disparate treatment of old people costs our economy some many billions of dollars a year. It drives up medical costs while subjecting elders to substandard care. Ageism on the job not only hurts elders, but also robs workplaces of valuable productivity. It also turns the generations against each other, instead of bringing families together to solve the problems that hurt us all. Applewhite says it's time to fight back against ageism, just as we fight against racism, sexism, and LGBTQ prejudice. Applewhite is on a mission to help catalyze a movement to make discrimination on the basis of age as unacceptable as any other kind. To that end, she runs the blogs This Chair Rocks and Yo, Is This Ageist?, led the team that developed a clearinghouse of anti-ageism resources, speaks widely on ageism, and, of course, wrote the book This Chair Rocks. Ashton Applewhite, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
This book, This Chair Rocks, explores a whole lot of myths about aging, and I was surprised over and over again. For example, that only 2.5% of Americans over 65 live in nursing homes, or that only 10% will get Alzheimer's. This is so different than the messages that we get that we're all going to end up with Alzheimer's and in nursing homes. What does it say about our society that probably most Americans fear they will end up in nursing homes or with dementia?
Well, I think a little bit of it is just human. We tend to remember insults and negative experiences more than the positive ones. And supposedly that goes back to, to Darwin and evolution. We remember the scary things that are harmful to us more than we remember life chugging along just fine. Alarmist headlines, terrifying headlines, scare stories, horror stories, we all click on them. And the fact is that most of us will chug along pretty darn well till the end is just not as grabbing, even if it is the narrative that ought to get more attention because it applies to the vast majority of us. The fact is that, if aging is framed as a problem, we can be persuaded to buy things to fix it. There's big air quotes around the fix or stop it. And of course, the only way to stop it is to die. And if the natural transitions that accompany getting older are pathologized and framed as disease, we can be persuaded to buy stuff to cure these things. And, what a market, right? Because everyone wakes up a day older.
And now you wrote in another piece that I went looking for because you have a blog and you've written quite a bit of posts for different publications. So I was interested to find this one about double standards. These double standards around age are everywhere, especially for women. And I'll just quote here. Silver hair on a young woman, she's styling. Silver hair on an older woman, she's let herself go. Trendy outfit on a young person, sharp. Trendy outfit on an older person, pathetic. So talk about those double standards.
I think the most sharpest and easiest to see double standard is by gender. The way women face the double whammy of ageism and sexism. And the, idea is that aging enhances men and devalues women. And we see this in the way that ageism affects women much younger. To take a very neutral example, women stop being promoted into managerial positions in the U.S. at age 34 because they might think about having a baby. And we all know your uterus and your brain cannot work at the same time. So it is in the workforce, another place, because women are penalized for appearing to look our age, God forbid. Economists have a charming term for this, the attractiveness penalty. And of course, when we compete to, quote unquote, stay young, which no one can do, you can only be the age you are. But when women do that, we reinforce the idea that the most important thing about us is how we look. And we reinforce sexism, and we reinforce ageism, and we reinforce, you know, the patriarchy that benefits from and works hard to keep all these systems in place.
And you go into a lot of the other major myths about aging. What first comes to your mind before we get into some of the ones that I listed?
Well, I think the biggest one you've already touched on, which this is this idea that somewhere north of 30 for women, maybe 40 for men, it's all downhill. When in fact, if you look around you at your older friends, I don't know anyone who actually wants to be any younger, no matter how terrified they are, no matter what their physical condition is. The fact is, if we lift our heads and look around at the older people around us, we see a very, very different story. I actually think that's why my work is getting such a good reception, even among people who aren't aware of this and weren't looking for it. They're, whether they know it or not, they are looking for a narrative about the second half of life, let's call it, that rings truer to our actual experience. You know, the idea that two-thirds of life is decline is just nutty. And I want to point out that ageism also affects young people. It is, we're being ageist anytime we make a judgment about someone or a group of people based on how old we think they are. Young people experience a lot of it, with people who assume that they couldn't possibly be competent or know enough to, you know, take on a job or whatever. And one of the things that makes your 20s hard, remember how rough your 20s were? But youth culture, of course, idolizes your 20s as the time you have your, you know, perfect sex with your perfect body, with your perfect boyfriend or girlfriend, and shaping up, that perfect career is shaping up, et cetera, et cetera. We know that, in fact, it's a really difficult and challenging time of life. And one of the things that makes it harder is living in an ageist society that says, if you're not having a perfect time now, well, we, you know, it's all going to get much worse very soon. And that weight itself is oppressive. That's a function of ageism. So that's one of the things I mean when I say ageism casts a shadow across our whole life, just like we are aging from the minute we're born. Aging is not something annoying that parents or celebrities do. It is something we embark on the minute we're born.
So some of the other myths, because you bring up this idea of the generations, and one of the most disturbing myths, I think, is that there's an assumption of a zero-sum game, you know, the generational smash-up, the gray tsunami that is going to overwhelm society with all these costs and destroy the lives of young people. Deconstruct that myth.
Well, that's a very big question. But zero-sum thinking, I mean, I just read a post in the British Guardian today about how all the old people are going to suck all the resources out to sea, and why don't we give some of it up because we're, you know, we're taking all the jobs and we're taking all the good things. This is not only not true. I mean, the depiction of older people as drags on the economy, as though at age 65, everyone sort of rolls over and, you know, stops contributing in any way, is flat out false. And, you know, you can find the data and the numbers in my book and on my blog, thischairrocks.com, because I don't want to reel off statistics and get them wrong. But I mean, just the volunteer work that older people do is worth many billions of dollars in the U.S. alone, and more older people are staying in the workforce, et cetera, et cetera. We're back to alarmism. All prejudice operates to pit people against each other. One example is moms who stay at home versus moms in the paid workforce arguing about who's a better mom, instead of joining forces to close the gender wage gap so women could choose whether or not to stay home. old versus young framing does the same thing. We're busy arguing about this was all about how old people should give up their places in life and in the workforce to young people. Older and younger people do not typically compete for the same jobs. That's a myth. Otherwise, when women entered the workforce, you know, in greater numbers in the 70s, there would have been fewer jobs. That's not the way it works. It is true in the narrowest sense if there's only one job in town, but that is a labor market problem, not a too many old people problem, right? So all this us versus them scarcity mentality in any domain operates to make us fearful and to keep us from joining up to combat the forces that benefit from inequality, that benefit from sexism and racism and poverty and all of that, to challenge the status quo.
So you say that we need a new generational compact. What would be some of the priorities of that compact?
A new generational compact is an idea that is as local or as general as you want it to be. I'm going to do what no sane author would ever do and mention someone else's book called Mark Friedman, F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N. He has a wonderful book called How to Live Forever, by which he means not how, God forbid, you know, how to, you know, never get old and never die, but how to live forever in terms of the legacy we leave behind for others. Probably the most hurtful stereotype I hear is that older people, baby boomers in particular, and I was born in 1952, so I am dead center in the boom, do not care about the world we leave behind about what we leave for other people, whether or not these happen to be your biological children. Let's use family in the broadest sense. We need to work together at all ages, obviously, to solve rising inequality, to help our poor, beleaguered planet, to address labor market problems. Older people now, there's very few pensions. Older Americans over 65 were the first group among whom poverty increased in the last census. Millennials, too, they not only have this crippling school debt, which we did not have when I was kids, but we're trying to make a living in an increasingly insecure job market, increasingly buffeted by global macroeconomic trends. Those same trends are really hard for older workers who are facing widespread workplace discrimination. We need to work across the generation for fixes that work for both ends of the spectrum, or they won't be sustainable, they won't be equitable, and they'll continue to be framed in a mean-spirited press as, why are we doing expensive stuff for needy old people instead of how are we building a society that supports people across the lifespan?
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with Ashton Applewhite about her manifesto against ageism, This Chair Rocks. Right, and just kind of staying on that idea of age discrimination in the workplace, I mean, you point out that, first of all, places where there is age discrimination, that it actually hurts the firm, that it costs the economy something like $65 billion a year. How does that work?
$63 billion a year is the cost of ageism in the U.S. in healthcare alone. I don't think anyone's tried to tabulate it in business because it's too big a field. But we know that diverse workforces are better places to work. We know they work better. We know you can reach a broader client base more effectively. We know they are especially effective in creative industries. And to have to say that age is a criterion for diversity, you know, is something I still have to say, but let me tell you, nobody says that's a dumb idea. We are living in a more diverse world, and the minute people hear that, they understand. I mean, it is crazy that we are so ageist that it's getting in the way of this multi-generational workforce, which we need as we face labor shortages in a number of fields, or just for the common sense point that, you know, if older people are forced out of the job market, who's going to care for us? How are we going to support ourselves if we can't stay on the job or get a new job when we're forced out? And a study just at the end of 2018 established that over 50% of American workers over 50 do not leave their jobs of their own free will. They are either late let go or made to leave by being treated in a way that makes it clear that their presence is not welcome. And ageism is in the workforce is often the first form of discrimination that white men encounter. you know, welcome to our world. I am eager for some of them to become spokespeople for the emerging movement to end ageism. But women, you know, face discrimination earlier than men, and women of color even more so. If you have a disability, even more so. So I think it's one reason there's so much chatter about ageism in tech is because it was the first time I think a lot of really wealthy young white men encountered the idea that, gee whiz, it's not a meritocracy out there. And it is soul crushing, you know, to be told that this thing that you got really good at and really like to do is disqualifying you for further employment doing that thing. I mean, what possible answer can you make against that? Argument can you make?
Yeah, so Ashton Applewhite, in this book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism, you point out actually that job performance improves with age. So this is another one of those myths that older people, olders as you call them, can't learn new tricks.
That's not true. It can take longer to learn something, but not if it's attached to something else, you know, we already know. And I would never say that older worker or older people are in any way better than younger people. That way we get back to the zero sum, you know, argument. The point is that mixed age groups are always better. Younger people may come up with more wild and crazy ideas that might not have occurred to older people, who may say, gee, we tried that in, you know, 2012 and it didn't work out so well. But I don't want to reinforce the stereotype that older people don't think of new things either. You know, there's always a trade-off. A perfect example being that older people tend to hurt themselves. If they hurt themselves on the job, we do take longer to heal, but we hurt ourselves less often. You know, we might take longer to process an idea, but there's neuroscience that shows it's because we're sifting through more data in our brains. We might come up with a more reasoned decision or be better at, you know, seeing the human side of things, balancing things in a workforce. So those, obviously, what the ideal workplace has a mixture of all these things that values each voice and comes up with the best decision. It's not either or, it's both and.
And you say that older workers score high in leadership and detail-oriented tasks, organization, listening, writing skills, and problem solving.
I mean, and the old saw about not being creative, if you've done the same thing for 30 years, you're probably not very creative at it anymore, and probably no one has asked you to come up with anything new. Give that older person a new task, and they will be every bit as creative as a young person.
Yeah, and I want to just kind of interject here, you know, the 2020 presidential election, where there is an awful lot of talk about old men running, wherein candidates as diverse as Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and Donald Trump are all likened to each other on the basis of age. I wonder if you could weigh in on...
I would be very happy to weigh in on that, because it is a very disturbing discourse. I mean, you know, Pete Buttigieg is running on this campaign of generational change, which is frankly hugely, hugely ageist, especially in the absence of evidence that a younger person is actually more qualified for the job. To say that someone is too old for something, or too young for that matter, is like saying they are too queer or too black. It is bigotry, straight and simple. It's framed as the age problem. Well, that saying gives me the heebie-jeebies, because it makes me think of the race problem. The race problem is racism. The age problem is ageism. It is a function, for example, of an ageist world in which experience is a liability. I mean, which is just a nutty idea. The issue is ideology, not age, right? No one, we don't want to be judged by our race or our gender or our age. What does a person stand for, and how do they say it, and can you get behind them? Health matters. A person in their 80s, 70s, I guess is the oldest candidate, you know, is indeed, statistically speaking, much closer to death than someone in their, you know, 50s. But that says nothing about the likelihood of any given individual. Most senators are in a lot better health than the average American. Bernie Sanders, not to say anything, you know, for or against his candidacy, but he seems to have the energy of a locomotive, if you ask me. Of course, he should have a physical, not performed in secret by a quack. Of course, his running mate should too. So should all the candidates, though, right? And the issue is the culture that we inhabit that makes age ugly and makes age a negative, not the candidate's age. To say that it's age alone is just as bigoted as ruling someone out on the basis of their sex or their skin color or anything else about ourselves we cannot change.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and we're talking with Ashton Applewhite about her manifesto against ageism, This Chair Rocks. And you know, I hear this often from older people even. So
yeah,
talk a little bit about, you know, the self-hating age or the internal ageism.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the many, many things. I mean, when I started this project, I started it because I was afraid of getting old. In hindsight, I didn't realize that at the time. And I was so skeptical of everything. And one of the startling things was that older people was realizing that older people can be the most ageist of all. It was just really hard to get my head around because you don't think of people of color as being racist or whatever. And the reason is because we live in a culture that bombards us with negative messages about age and aging from childhood on. And unless we stop to question it, it becomes part of our identity. And that is, it's one reason older people tend to be so ageist. And you hear people say, oh, you know, I'm too old to do that, or he's too old to run for president. Well, you might be too lazy to do that. You might be too smart to do that. You might be, you know, too busy to do that, but you're never too old or too young. Age is never the reason.
So Ashton Applewhite, let's talk a little bit about the greatest fear and bugaboo, which is cognitive decline, Alzheimer's. I mean, this is a good segue because a lot of people say, well, the reason you're too old to run for president is because you might be like Ronald Reagan and have Alzheimer's. So talk about the different kinds of cognitive decline and also the benefits of aging cognitively.
The chapter in the book is on the older brain. And, you know, I am not a Pollyanna about aging. There are real things to worry about getting older, getting sick, running out of money, ending up alone. Those fears are legitimate and real. But the issue is that our fears are so far out of proportion to the reality. The figure that you cited at the beginning of this chat, 1 out of 10 people have over 65 have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Now, remember, that could mean that 2.5% in nursing homes, most of them do have severe dementia and they do require, you know, actual nursing care. But if it's 1 out of 10, there is no way it can be typical of aging, right? And if you were to have a curve, and actually I'm itching to get my hands on the actual data, if anyone knows how to get it. If you were to have a XY axis and Y is the incidence of Alzheimer's and X is how old you are, it would go up very, very steeply in our 80s and into our 90s. So the odds of having Alzheimer's in your early late life, if you will, are much, much, much lower than in your 90s. It is a terrifying disease. It is a real, genuine public health threat, not poo-pooing that. But the real epidemic is anxiety over memory loss and where it kicks in to being bad for us is you think, you know, if I can't remember where I put the keys, oh crap, I'm getting dementia. And any prophecy about our function, physical or mental function, but especially when it comes to our cognitive well-being, is important. You know, if you start to believe that you are less competent, it leads to learned helplessness and a less competent and accurate view of yourself in the world. I'd love to bring up a fascinating new study out of Yale. There's so much data that shows that attitudes towards aging affect how our mind and body function at the cellular level. The latest one, it's about a year old now, out of the Yale School of Public Health, shows that having, they call it a positive attitude towards aging. I say a realistic attitude towards aging. If you actually know the facts, this is not happy talk. A realistic attitude towards aging protects against Alzheimer's, even in people who have the gene that predisposes them to the disease. The idea is that this positive attitude is a buffer against stress and prejudice, which are the effects of living in an ageist world that bombards us with messages that says you're incompetent, you're failing. Let me just mention that I have been writing, thinking out loud, really, in blog form for over a decade on this at thischairrocks.com/blog. It's searchable. So if you want to learn more about any of this, enter public health, enter Alzheimer's, enter dementia, you know, enter Yale, and you can find the research right there online if you don't want to spring for my book. Although, of course, the book has it all in one handy place.
And we are talking with Ashton Applewhite about her book, This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. So let's get to the manifesto part, because you counsel a new approach to aging with some wonderful ideas. So first of all, let's start off with, what does it mean to become an old person in training?
That was a phrase that I heard early on, and I didn't realize how important it would become to me, but it's I heard it from a geriatrician named Joanne Lynn. She described herself as an old person in training, and I went, geez, I don't know where I'm going with all this, but I know that that's what I have become. It's just a mental trick. All prejudice takes root in what a sociologist called othering, seeing a group of people as other than ourselves, other nationality, other race, other sports team. The weird thing about ageism is that that other is us, our own future older selves. And ageism takes root in this idea that somehow, I mean, even though we know it's not rational, but no prejudice is rational. We know we're going to get old, but an awful lot of people spend a lot of effort pretending that it's not going to happen or just trying not to think about it at all. If you can become an old person in training, which is simply to acknowledge that one day you're going to get old, that older you can be as far off on the horizon as you need her to be. When we're young, it is really, really hard to imagine being old. And that's not ageism. You know, that's just human. We age slowly, just like when you're a kid. You know, I used to marvel, like, why are these grown-ups sitting in chairs when they could be racing around, right? Well, guess what? I became one. If you become an old person in training, you sort of slip the noose. You never get caught up on this hamster wheel of denial, which just fills us with dread and anxiety because we know, if we're lucky, we are going to get old. And it helps you look at and listen to the older people around you, right? Instead of seeing them as other, if you see an older person doing something interesting, behaving in a way that seems admirable, you file it away. If you see older people who don't seem to have learned a thing of value along the way, and there are plenty of them, it's one reason you don't hear me talking about wise old people, you know, you say, gee, that's a behavior I'd like to avoid. And so it's like looking through the periscope of an open mind, if you will, at the territory you will someday inhabit. And it breaks down this us, them, othering of you against your own future self. And it's really a crucial little mental trick in shaping the old age that you want.
You also talk about the concept of agefulness, which I really loved. The concept of agefulness, kind of being all the ages that you are.
Yeah, it's a lovely idea. You know, just like the idea of ageism as a prejudice against your future self, I figured that out because I thought about it for a while. So does everyone who thinks about this. That is not a idea unique to me. Neither is the idea that we contain all the ages we have ever been. That is the way Anne Lamott phrases it. And so I use that as an epigraph to the book. But many, many other people say this. An ageist culture, I think, gives us this idea that one of these days you're going to wake up old and you know, and everything's going to will have gone to hell. And, you know, of course, there is no old-young divide. You know, there is no point at which everything changes. Aging is a spectrum. We're always older than some people and younger than others. That's one reason I like the term to use the terms olders and youngers as nouns rather than old and young. There is no binary. As we age, all the experiences that we had when we were young are still accessible to us. I mean, even in people with severe dementia, those early memories, you know, remain accessible to us. So yes, there are losses, but most of the losses have to do with physical function, you know, not identity and not this sense of, I mean, I like to say that aging, again, not to soft pedal the losses, but it is also this rich, rich, rich process of accretion and addition. In which, I mean, that is the reason no one actually wants to be any younger. You don't get to just swap out, you know, your 18-year-old cartilage. We know no matter how ageist we are, no matter how apprehensive we remain, that our years are what make us us and that they are rich and precious and invaluable. And that's, so I call that agefulness. I'm not trying to put ageful into the world as a new vocabulary word, although I like it as a antidote to agelessness, which you see about 500 times if you walk down the skincare aisle, for example. And I think the term agelessness is ageist because I think it's based in age denial, pretending we're not aging. A woman at a talk, I just crossed the country on a book tour, and a woman of color who attended one of my book talks added something very interesting. She said, "I think saying you're ageless is like saying you're colorblind," which a lot of white people do. They say, "I don't see color." The problem with that is that if you don't see color and race, you can't see racism. Right. And we do see it. You know, we are animals. We see that difference. And if you don't see and acknowledge the difference, you can't see and acknowledge disparities in treatment because of it.
That's a great point. And also, of course, you talk about the happiness curve and that, in fact, people who are older tend to be happier.
That was when I first encountered that. It's called the U curve of happiness. I mean, I just assumed that one thing that must be awful about getting older would be this. I actually envisioned the shadow of the Grim Reaper stretching across the sad, lonely iron bedstead. I assumed that the knowledge that time was growing short would fill people with dread. And that's not the way it happens. Part of the underpinnings of that U-curve are that as time is short, we become consciously start to use that time more wisely. Kids live in the moment because they don't know how to do anything else. And the very old do the same because they know that time is short. That's one part of it. And another part of it, getting back to the older brain, is that we get better at mediating our emotions. We tend to think more positively. It's a positivity bias. And we get better at mediating negative emotions like anger and envy and fear. And all those are reasons why that curve obtains across culture, across income group, everywhere in the world.
Well, it's certainly an inspiring message. Ashton Applewhite, your book is This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. We've barely covered the surface. It's just a fascinating deep dive into this issue. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Ashton Applewhite. Go to writersvoice.net to see her TED Talk about ageism. Next up, geriatrician Louise Aronson talks about elderhood. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we're talking about older age and ageism. In our first segment, we explored ageism and its social impact. Now, we turn to the health of elders and how ageism affects their health care. It's something Dr. Louise Aronson has been thinking about over her career working as one of too few geriatricians in America. In her book, Elderhood, she uses stories from her quarter century of caring for patients and draws from history, science, literature, and popular culture, as well as her own life, to weave a vision of old age that's neither nightmare nor utopian fantasy. It's a vision full of joy and wonder, frustration and outrage, and hope about aging, medicine, and humanity. Well, Louise Aronson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a really wonderful book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. All these three themes are really woven throughout the book, but I want to start with a different thread that was it's really a wonderful part of the story, and that is how you became and then developed as a geriatrician. So tell us a little bit about that story. How did you come to this field?
It just never even occurred to me at the beginning. Like most young people, I didn't give much thought to old people. I had grandparents I adored, but I didn't think of them as old people. I thought of them as family members, although I understood they were old, and that was a little different than being parents, who also seemed old naturally when you're young. So when I was first in college and then in medical school, I really thought, well, maybe I'll work with kids, or I had worked on the Thai-Cambodian border with refugees, and I just didn't think about older people. I think when I began to consider geriatrics, or even just sort of medical care of older people, or older people as one of our many population groups, was probably during my residency. And that was for two reasons. One was that just by happenstance, I happened to have a lot of older patients, you know, people between the ages of, you know, late 60s to hundreds in my clinic. And that's just chance. Some of my colleagues had, you know, different sorts of patients, more younger ones, more ones with certain diseases. And I just got that by chance, and I found I loved it. And I loved it because as people get older, your care is less good if you're really just treating the disease. You have to know who the person is and what their life circumstances are and, you know, what they can do already. And if they're at a stage where they're going to need some help, who's around to do that. And that gave me not just the opportunity, but sort of the need to engage them more as human beings, which was what had gotten me into medicine in the first place. And there are fields of medicine where people really just focus on the disease or the organ, and that was never my interest. So geriatrics, more than most fields, really let me think about the whole person in his or her context as well as everything medical. And the second part, I think, was just this element of story that the longer you've lived, the more story you have. And I happen to be in San Francisco, where people come from all over the world. And I just loved the things I learned and the interactions I had with people and how sort of polite and generous and I don't know, it just, the interactions felt substantially different to me. I tell a story in the book of a call night where a young man woke me up because he'd been out dancing and his shoulder was bothering him. But it turned out his shoulder had been bothering him for a month, and he's out dancing at 2 a.m. and decides that's when he should call me. I was asleep. Meanwhile, the next morning, you know, just as it became a sort of reasonable hour, I get a call from a woman in her 80s who's had a stroke several hours previously, but you didn't want to wake me up and disturb me. And it's not like all young people, you know, do those things, or all old people are so considerate. But there was a pattern in a couple of things, in just sort of the quality of the interactions as human beings, and also this sense of older people that they didn't have a right to ask for things. And I really wanted to say, like, absolutely, the reason you have a doctor is so that when you need her, she will be there. And so it seemed like an opportunity to improve medicine and also to empower people to say they don't need to be apologizing for their life stage, that there are so many wonderful things that I enjoy about it. And when you need help, you should ask for it.
Well, there's so much there to unpack, but I'm going to start with, you know, what you said about treating a disease versus an illness. What is the difference?
Well, this comes from the physician, anthropologist, psychiatrist, anthropologist Arthur Kleinman. I mean, I'm sure it's been articulated in other ways, but he was the first to really sort of articulate it clearly in the modern era, whereas the disease is sort of the biological or pathophysiological process. It's kind of what's happening at the cell and organ level. And the illness is the particular human being's experience of that disease. And that just makes a huge difference. You know, a broken leg is a very different experience for someone who's 2 years old or, you know, 52 years old. But equally, if you're already a person who has a little trouble walking, it can be catastrophic. And if you're an athlete, it can be catastrophic. But those are for two really different reasons. So the illness is really particular and so important.
Yeah. Well, first I want to ask you, is there a difference between a gerontologist and a geriatrician?
Oh, thank you for asking this question, because it's a source of constant confusion. But yes, so a gerontologist is a person who usually has master's or PhD level training in aging generally, whereas a geriatrician is a physician who has subspecialized in the care of older adults. So the word geriatrics actually was coined in 1909 by a physician called Ignaz Nascher in New York, who really came up with it as an analog to pediatrics. So pediatrician, pediatrics, geriatrician, geriatrics. And so we are experts in the care of, you know, people over age 60 or 70, the way pediatricians are experts in the care of people under age 20.
And there are very few geriatricians. Talk about the dearth of them and why that's so.
So there are not quite 6,000 geriatricians. And just to give you a little perspective on that, those are the members of the Geriatric Society. But if you look at the Pediatric Society, they actually have almost 70,000 members. So that is a huge order of magnitude difference. And it's all the more important because older people require a great deal more medical care than younger people. So, you know, luckily, young people don't get sick that often, and we have a pretty decent number of pediatricians to care for them. Unfortunately, you know, older people do require more medical care, outpatient, inpatient, of all, you know, they take more medicines, and we really don't have an appropriate workforce. I think the reasons for this are many. Some of it is just sort of the way history moves. There were never very many older people, and so it was possible to be a sort of adult doctor. So I started as an internist, so a general adult doctor, and you would just take care of people throughout old age. But old age then also didn't last as long for most people. Yes, there were the people who lived to be very old, but most people didn't. So there weren't, as over the 20th century, our human lifespan doubled, the extra decades that we have acquired, which for many people is 20, 30, and sometimes 40, are really the decades of older ages. So there are all these stages of life that really didn't exist. And so things weren't really built for them. And there were so few people with it, people could say, well, we don't need too many doctors of that kind. So obviously that has changed. I think there are two other problems worth noting, though. One is that ageism is one of the isms that sort of universally accepted. I mean, there's really good data on this across cultures. And actually, if you look at there's an ageism map that people have made of different countries, the U.S. fares very poorly. We're a particularly ageist society. And people in medicine are human beings. They're products of their culture, just like everyone else. And so there is a sense of, oh, it's probably not worth treating them, or it's less valuable. There are actually, I said there were two things, but now I'm thinking there's a third one. There's something else too, which is that when we're treating younger people, whether adults or children, we often look for what's called Occam's razor, and that is the single unifying diagnosis that pulls everything together. As people get older, you are less and less likely to have or find Occam's razor. More often, it looks like there are five problems, and there probably are five problems, and there might even be eight problems. And people find that overwhelming and sort of hard to deal with, particularly because they actually don't get much training in geriatrics. So they lack the skills to cope with it. Those of us who have that training find it meaningful, engaging, interesting, and all those other things. But I think it makes people feel, you know, out of control and less competent, and that makes it less desirable for them to be interested in it. The third and final thing on sort of the medical front is that I think in some ways we geriatricians have done ourselves a disservice. The argument has been for many decades that because there are so few of us, we should focus on the oldest and frailest. In other words, the people who most need our specialized knowledge, skills, and training. And that makes really good sense morally. The problem with that is it makes geriatrics seem like it's about sort of end stage old age care instead of being what it was initially intended to be, which is care for people throughout the decades and generations of old age. Across all cultures and for at least, you know, the last 5,000 years, every society has sort of defined old as beginning somewhere between 60 and 70. And that's biologically, it's socially, it's spiritually, it's sort of all the things we think about and do. And so when geriatrics is associated just with the end, it appears to be small, and that makes it less interesting to younger people. I mean, a pediatrician is trained to take care of neonates and infants and toddlers and kids and tweens and teens and young adults. And we need to do the same thing from people when they're in their 60s and they're beginning to feel aging, whether they're, you know, planning on working another 20 years and still running marathons or not. And we need to be able to take care of people in their hundreds in whatever, you know, conditions they find themselves living in and whatever they want from their lives. And I think if we go there, it will be bigger and more inviting, and we'll have a much bigger workforce. So that's my hope for that.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with geriatrician Louise Aronson about her book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging, Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. A lot of this book really talks about, you know, just how dysfunctional our medical system is where it comes to, you know, people in general. I mean, we're bad on the indices of health in a whole range of things.
Oh, yeah.
Be maternal health or child health or certainly elder health. But there are special issues in terms of how the medical system deals with older people. And, you know, one of the most striking examples you give in the book, or stories really that you tell in the book, is about a woman named Eva. And I wonder if you could tell her story to us as the kind of emblematic example of all the different ways in which the medical system fails our elders.
Right. So this was a woman I met just by coincidence because I had my own appointment and I went into the building sort of late at night for the last appointment of the day, had my appointment and came out, and I had seen her on the curb when I first went in. And then when I came out, I almost didn't see her, but she was over on the side and clearly her ride hadn't come. And at this point, you know, it was December, so it was dark and cold. And she had looked, you know, really well put together sort of person in her mid-80s probably. And now she was sort of looking a little ragged. And so I just sort of stopped and I said, you know, are you okay? Is there anything I can do? And it turned out her ride hadn't come. And she had this thing on her phone to call a cab, but it actually sent it to her apartment. So I ended up giving her a ride home. And then it turned out where she lived was up so many steps. And she wasn't moving because she had a rent-controlled apartment from years ago. And it took us, you know, like the better part of an hour to get up the steps. So I got to know her. And what I heard was that she really only left for medical appointments at this point, and that she had tons of doctors. She had had so many doctor visits in the last year, but her life was falling apart. And she'd also had two hospitalizations. And each time, basically, they had treated the medical problems and then left her with, you know, huge functional and social losses and just really just dismantled her life and well-being and paid no attention to any of that, from her ability to walk to her ability to take care of herself in certain ways. There were just all these other factors that nobody had really quite paid attention to. And it turned out she got care at my institution. So I got her permission to look in her electronic medical record and to see if I could help in some way. So I looked, and she had all these great doctors, you know, people I trained at the same time as or who had been my teachers. And, you know, they had all written these, you know, lovely good notes and were thoughtful. And some of them had even noticed that, you know, her biggest problems were certain types of pain or inability to get around the way she needed to. But nobody had done the parts of the physical exam that were related to that or any of the referrals or treatments that might have helped her cope with that. So basically, her diseases were under good control, but the things that were really dominating her life, and she had still been working into her 80s and was in the process of retiring because she just couldn't go on. Nobody had addressed the things that were really what was impacting her day-to-day life, the quality of her life, the meaning of her life, her ability to function in her own life. And part of that is really because they're not trained in it. I mean, you know, people get a matter of hours of training on how to care for older adults, contrasted to many months of training on kids and many years of training on younger adults. And then because of the steps, it was costing her a fortune to get back and forth to these appointments that weren't really necessarily helping her. So it's just sort of paradigmatic of our system that the diseases were well controlled, but the life was essentially destroyed. And no one really had the training or skills or knowledge to look at the bigger picture, to address the things that were actually really making her life very nearly not worth living. But this happens all the time. I mean, I had two people in clinic last week with the same thing. I mean, just tons of medicines. Their only outside activity is going to the doctor. The diseases are being managed, and the life is just their worst nightmare.
Yeah, and one thing I think surprised me is that as a geriatrician, you actually do house calls.
Yes. Yes, we have a house calls practice, and actually, you know, more and more places do. It's coming back. We've had one a bit longer since the 90s in San Francisco because we have our crazy hills and houses built up vertically because we have water on three sides. So we don't really have ranch style homes very often. And our apartment buildings also were built at a time where, yeah, they put in elevators, but they were basically thinking of a woman with some groceries and a few small kids, so that you usually have to walk up like eight steps to get to the elevator. So more people become homebound here than they do in certain other places.
Yeah. So in the case of Eva, I mean, when you say it was really expensive, she had to pay people to carry her up and down because she had such bad arthritis. So it was like $3 per step. And then you did kind of take over her care. What are some of the things that you were able to do for Eva that, you know, shows how what geriatrics can actually do to help the quality of life of older people?
Well, just one clarification was she was not in my catchment area, so we sort of divide the city geographically. So one of my colleagues saw her, but, you know, did what I would have done also, of course. So a few things. First, the house calls. That saved her a ton of money that she could then spend on having someone help her a couple times a week. So everything from getting her meds at the pharmacy, getting her healthier food in places, doing some of the heavy lifting around the home to keep it clean. She had a cat so that, you know, her asthma wouldn't flare and she wouldn't trip over things, et cetera, et cetera. So that saved her so much money she could afford some help. Even though she didn't love the idea of help, she could see how in small doses it might really help her life. My colleague also looked at her diseases, and a lot of them were really well controlled, which meant that they just needed to be monitored. You didn't have to go into a specialist if it's under perfect control. And these were all sort of common diseases, so that she needed many fewer appointments. And the primary care doctor who made the house call could just handle those things. There were also things about her medications, some of which were clearly making her worse. There are medicines that are very helpful in younger age and become less so. Actually, it's both that the benefits go down and that the risks go up. So some changes in her medication helped with her function. There were simple things like targeted joint treatments instead of taking some of the medicines that affect your entire body, but really, you know, focusing on the pain in a particular knee that was helpful. Getting her exercise training. So we've actually known since the first great study on this was published in 1994 that at any age, you know, up to and through 100, people can build muscle mass and strength, and that increases their functional ability. So also getting her some targeted physical therapy. And, you know, physical therapists, like physicians, like the rest of us, have some ageism. So they tend not to push older people very hard. You know, they'll work on range of motion or little bits of walking. But we know that if older people lift weights and do balance exercises, they can walk better, they feel better. They are much less likely to fall. If they do fall, they can get themselves back up. And you can do all those things. Doesn't matter the age. So we often have to write these strong prescriptions of, like, you know, build up the resistance training, add weights, add heavier weights. So all those things really helped her a lot become more of the person that she had been before the hospitalizations and the year before I met her. You know, and then the medical system crazily considers, you know, its sort of drugs and procedures more medical than other things. When in fact, if you look at certain things like heart disease, like, you know, you were always hearing about statin drugs. Well, it turns out eating a Mediterranean diet helps you, you know, more than twice as much as statin drugs. And statin drugs have all these bad side effects, like they give people diabetes and muscle disintegration. And Mediterranean diet side effects are that your blood pressure will be better and your blood sugar will be better and you'll feel better and you'll sleep better and like all these things. But that's not considered medicine. And it's just the biases of the medico-industrial complex, really, which has done so much good for us. I mean, that's why we're living longer. But it's sort of created this situation and hasn't shown the adaptability and creativity to apply, you know, there's a lot about evidence-based medicine. And well, the evidence is clear that certain things help more than others, and they're not always the drugs and the procedures.
This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with Dr. Louise Aronson about her book, Elderhood. You do go through the stages of, you know, of elderhood. In many ways, I think we could even look at them as functional rather than based on age, because you could have who's in their 90s, who, you know, who may be in better shape than someone in their 70s. But there is a lot in this book that's quite frightening about the later stages or the less functional stages. And, you know, talked about the impact of decline. One of the things I found interesting is how violent you feel the medical profession is in its treatment, well, of people in general, but, you know, the impact of this, especially when people may have cognitive decline.
Yeah, no, this happens in both directions, actually. So, yeah, I tell the story of a guy where the medical team asked me what to do. And I said, you know, why don't you ask him? And they said, well, he has dementia. And I think he was 101. And I was like, he doesn't have dementia. Are his hearing aids in? And they just sort of had this awkward silence, because there's often an assumption at a certain age that everybody has cognitive impairment. And while it does become more common with age, it's not universal. There are some things like a little slowing in response time and things like that that are pretty universal if you're going to live to 100, but that doesn't mean you can't answer the question. On the other hand, I've also had other patients who did have dementia, but, you know, were so able to have the conversation and, you know, very sociable and articulate. And then people don't appreciate that, you know, they can't remember what they told you 3 minutes ago, much less, you know, what happened to them before that. So I think, you know, some of the violence that happens, it takes a few forms. One is not understanding that for an older person, what you need to assess before you treat and decide treatment might be different. So, you know, we talk about history, you know, when somebody comes in with something acute in particular, but generally, we talk about the history being 70 or 80% of diagnosis. Well, some people with dementia are very articulate, but they're making everything up. So if you base your treatment on the story they've just told you, which has nothing to do with the reality of their lives, you may do all kinds of tests and all kinds of harm that weren't needed. And, you know, almost all tests have pretty serious harms. And at the same time, you're going to be missing what it is they really need. So there are things like that that don't make sense. We also don't consider that as you become older, your physiological reserve goes down, so that for particularly harsh treatments, the benefits are much lower and the risks are much higher. And we know, like, when people with certain organ system problems or kids, we adjust doses, but we've traditionally never studied older people. They're either frankly excluded based on age or excluded on the basis of having other diseases. But then they get the results and they apply those results to the older people, having said previously that they were different cases and their conditions would affect the results. And so then you get bad results. But what happens when you get bad results is people say, oh, well, they were old and sick, so what do you expect? So I think we have pretty good data that older people are, you know, among the populations most harmed by medications, hospitalization, et cetera. And I actually fear that that is a tip of the iceberg because we haven't studied them. Now, before you get totally depressed, the NIH passed a new ruling that began this January, which is that you really have to include older people. They're paying attention. I do feel like the tides are really turning. And more health systems and hospitals are thinking about age and how it influences things, you know, in people's lifespan. But we really need to think about it and not in the traditional ways. So some people are harmed by what we call overtreatment and undertreatment. Overtreatment is when you pretend like being 88 instead of 58 doesn't make a difference, and you give the same harsh chemo when the years the person's going to get are far fewer and their body's ability to withstand it is far lower. So that's overtreatment potentially, you know, not considering age. And then undertreatment is when you say, oh, well, this person's so hard, we're not going to do anything. And you don't actually look at their functional status. Because as you said earlier, some 90-year-olds are just healthier and fitter than some 65-year-olds. So age alone is not a good dividing line. And so then you're depriving someone of a treatment that might really help him or her. So that's another form of violence, I would say, in the healthcare system. But I do think, and you know, a big part of this book is to get us all to think about what this means and to make the change we want to see, which, if you don't mind me talking a little bit more, I'll just make a larger point about this, which is that I think we as a society often use the word old the way I described medicine using it for people who are really frail. Like, people don't consider themselves old until they're frail. But actually, sort of biologically, socially, by all the other ways we segregate age groups, it happens much, much sooner than that. It really does happen between ages of 60 or 70, give or take. You know, we're all different. And by pushing old to the far reaches of old age, we do a couple of things. One is we lose opportunities for treating elderhood the same way we currently treat adulthood and childhood, with an understanding that there are subphases and different strengths and opportunities and challenges for each subphase, and sort of designing our society, our restaurants, our cars, our everything else to accommodate those different phases. The other thing is that by pushing it away, by saying, oh, I'm not old, we make old this distant, scary thing, and then we ignore it. We leave it because it's until we get there, which is right at the moment where we can do the least to make it good. And so we create the old age we fear by pushing old into those nether reaches. And instead, if old were this big, long, varied thing, and we talked to the people in its later stages and treated them like the human beings they are and created systems for their care and support, it wouldn't be so onerous. So much of what's horrible about it, some of it is intrinsic. You know, there's no arguing that. But we don't talk about how horrible it is to be a toddler. And toddlers have all kinds of handicaps if you judge them by adult standards. So why is it that if you're a 98-year-old, that's considered all failing and we're not going to create systems and social supports to make your life more meaningful and pleasant? It's a decision we've made as a society, and I think it's a bad one. And that creates so much of the fear that people have about being old.
Well, that's terrific. And so is your book, Elderhood, Redefining Aging and Transforming Medicine, Reimagining Life. I think it's a really important dive into both the philosophy, the ethics, as well as the science of how we can do aging better and how we treat it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Dr. Louise Aronson is a practicing geriatrician and professor of medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, where she currently leads a campus-wide health humanities and social advocacy initiative. She's also the author of A History of the Present Illness, which was a finalist for the Chautauqua Prize and the Pen America Debut Fiction Award. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.